Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Yevamos Daf Tzadi. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief four-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf Gemara before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins at the top line of Daf Tzadi. You will notice that we have triangles that appear. Actually, several of them on the first line. We're beginning with the end of the line, the inverted triangle Toshma. And this is essentially a continuation of the topic that we began during our last year, where we saw Rabba express his amazement at Rav Chisda's interpretation of the issue concerning Hafroshas Truma Tamea on Torah, where Rav Chisda said that if one intentionally did so, was tithed from Tome to exempt Tor, the Truma is nothing. Nothing has been been accomplished. And Rabbo raised the problem that on a Torah level, it is considered an effective tithing. How could it be then that the rabbis would come along and declared it because of Gzera Shema Yifsha, because of the fear that the owner might not tithe again as he is expected to? So the rabbi said that what you declared as a tithe is nothing. How can that be when the Torah says it is a tithe? And in other terms, using the rabbinic style, how is it that where in the world do you come off with this idea that the Yesh Koyach L'Chachomim L'Akor Dover Min HaTorah? Where do the Chachomim come off having the right to uproot something that was intended by the Torah? And that was Rabbo's attack, if you will, on Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda turned the tables and says to Rabbo, what are you amazed at? There are many sources where you see this happening. And now we continue with another one of those sources. Look at the previous Daf Pei Tes to see where we explained the markings. But in the interest of those who are not first-time listeners, we continue now. Toshma. I do note, by the way, this is a very long point. In other words, Rav Chisda is going to be spending more than half of this omid in making the point. Toshma, ochal truma tamea, mishalem chulin tahorim. If a person ate unintentionally truma tamea, defiled truma, he is to repay with chulin tahorim, with chulin that is pure, that's undefiled. And we take a look at the Rashi at the top line. Mishaim chulim torim dechtiv v'nosan l'kohen ez hakodesh. When a non-kohen eats from truma wrongfully, he's not allowed to eat from truma. He's supposed to compensate. Truma, of course, is the tithe given from one's produce to kohanim. So he's supposed to compensate the kohen for that which was wrongfully consumed, and he gives the pasuk says he gives the kohen as a kodesh, and we interpret that to mean dovah haroy lios kodesh, something that is fit to become sanctified. The perek kol shah, that's mentioned in Maseches Pesachim in the second perek. We continue in the Gemara. Shilem chulim tameim. Let us say the Yisrael paid not with chulim tahorim, but with defiled chulin. Sumchus omer, mishum Rebbe Meir, b'shogeg tashlumov tashlumin, b'mezid ein tashlumov tashlumin. If done unintentionally, so it's considered a compensation. If he does so intentionally, it's considered a non-compensation. It's a knas. We levy a fine upon him by requiring him, by declaring that which he paid as a non-payment. The Chachamim say, Echot zeh ve'echot zeh, tashlum of tashlumin, whether he pay with chulin tahorim or he pay with chulin. Repeat that. The chacham say whether it's shogeg or mezid, the tashlumim are considered tashlumin. The chozer umeshalem chulin tahorim. Let us correct ourselves. We have a slight error here. The chacham say whether he pays with chulin tahorim or he pays with chulin tameim, it's a good tashlumin. But if he paid with the chulin tameim, he has to pay back with chulin tahorim. V'havinon bo, and we ask, b'mezid ein tashlumov tashlumin. You said in the source that if a person ate truma tameya and he paid back with chulin tameim, it's not considered a good compensation. So we ask in wonderment, why should it not be a good compensation? Tavol of brocha, he deserves a blessing for that. Di ochal minei midi delo kochazile bimei tumasoi. The Yisrael ate truma tameya. That's something that's not fit to the kohen, even when the kohen himself is tamei. Truma tameya must be burnt; it cannot be eaten. So the wrong that had been done was the consumption on the part of the Israel of truma tameya. And then what does he pay back? And he pays back chulin tameim. Chulin is mundane produce. Though it happens to be defiled, if the kohen himself has experienced defilement, he may have touched dead sherets, he may have become tamei through other reasons, he may have had certain types of male sightings, discharges that make him tamei. When he's tamei, so he can't eat truma, what can he eat? He can eat chulin that's tamei. So what has happened here is actually seemingly very fine form of compensation. The eating, initial eating of the truma was truma tameya. That's not something fit to the kohen. The kohen cannot even eat from that, and he received this compensation, chulin tameyim, something he can eat from when he's tamei. V'omar Rava, v'amri lo kedi. Rava answers. Rava explains. Some say kedi, kedi means without any names. Chisuri mechaser v'hachi katani. We have to go over the source again with added information. Ochal truma tameya. If truma tameya was eaten mishalim koldu, then whatever is used to pay back, that's fine. Ochal truma tahora, if the Yisrael ate truma tahora, which he was not entitled to eat, mishalim chulin tahorin. He compensates with chulin that's tahor. Shilem chulin tameyim, if he paid back with chulin that's tomei. Sumchus Omer Mishum Rabbi Meir. Sumchus, quoting Rabbi Meir, says, Sumchus is a name of a famous scholar. Sumchus says in the name of Rabbi Meir, B'shogeg Tashlumov Tashlumen, B'mezid Ein Tashlumov Tashlumen. If he paid back with the Chulin Temeim, which he really shouldn't have done, but he did so unwittingly, it's okay. It's a good compensation. If, however, he did so intentionally, so it's not considered a compensation. Whether intentional or not, or whether not intentional or intentional, tashlum of tashlumin, it's a good compensation, this compensation of chulin tamein. V'chozer mishalim chulin torim, and he has to recompensate with a payment of chulin that's tahor. Now, let's focus on Rebbe Meir. He was quoted by Sumchus. And we saw under Rabbi Meir's name that if chulin tameim was used to pay back for the consumption of the truma tahora, and the chulin tameim was paid intentionally, so he said ein tashlum of tashlumin. V'ha'ha'cha. In this case, d'midoraiso tashlum al yahave. The payment of chulin tameim is a fine compensation. It's a full-fledged compensation when given to the kohen. It becomes property, it becomes a possession of produce owned by the kohen. The mekadesh bu kohen isha tafsulah kiddushi. If the kohen were to use the chulin tameim that he received and use that as as a monetary equivalent in marrying a woman. He would offer that as marriage to a woman. He would offer a basket full of apples or of grain that was hulin to man, offered to him as compensation. He would offer this to the woman as marriage money. She becomes his wife. That's tofsu lo kiddushi. The kiddushin takes hold. V'omer rabbanan ein tashlumov tashlumin. And the rabbanan come along and said, no, it's not payment. Not payment means it doesn't belong to the kayin. And that which he gave to the woman wasn't his to give to her. And she's not really married. V'kos sharin on eishes ishlamo. And by declaring it as non-tashlumin, you're declaring in effect that everything that happened henceforth was of no consequence, that the marriage is not a marriage, and she can marry someone else. But on a Torah level, she is considered married to this Kohen. So the rabbis are coming along and undoing her marriage, thereby, in effect, releasing or freeing a married woman to marry someone else. But she's married. And yet, you see, that happens. So that you see that the rabbis have the power to come and oikir dover min haTorah. This is Rav Chisda's point to Rabba. The Gemara continues. Rabba responds. He says, that doesn't prove anything. My ein tashlum of tashlumim dekomer Rabbi Meir. What was meant by Rabbi Meir when he said that the payment is not a payment? The boy, the mahadr shlumi chulin tahorin. It doesn't mean that it doesn't belong to the Kohen. It does belong to the Kohen. All that it means is that the Yisrael has to pay again. He has to pay chulin tahorin. The Gemara asks, I hachi, sumchus hainu rabbonin. If that be the case, then that which sumchus quoted in the name of the Rebbe Meir is the same as that which the rabbonin said. The rabbonin said that if it was paid, whether it's paid b'shogeg or mazid, you have to compensate again. And now you're saying that that's all Rebbe Meir was saying, that you have to compensate again? What's the difference? And if the two appear, if Sumchus appears along with the Chachamim in the same source, they must be saying something different. Omar Rav Acho Brei de Rav Ika. Now here you'll have after Rav Chisda's, let's say, opposition to Rabbo's explanation of the source. So now Rabbo's a response on behalf of Rabbo, and that's Rav Acho says, there is a point of difference. Konsu shoygeg otu mezid ika binayu. Let us say chulin tameim was used to compensate for the consumption of the truma tahora, and the chulin tameim was paid unintentionally. It was unwitting compensation. He didn't realize that it was chulim tameim, or he didn't know there was something wrong with that, and he did it b'shoygeg. Do we expect of him to compensate again? So that will be the point of difference. According to Rabbi Meir, the payment done b'shogeg is fine, and you don't have to pay again. According to the Chumim, we don't want you to get away with it, even though it was done b'shogeg, in anticipation of someone who would do it b'mezid. So just like when someone does it b'mezid, someone does it intentionally, he has to pay again, and everyone agrees with that. Even if you do it b'shogeg, even if it was done unintentionally, we want you to pay again as well. That's the opinion of the Chumim. Not so, Rabbi Meir. Toshma. Here we go with a fourth attempt on the part of Rav Chisda to make his point that it's a given that the Chachamim have the power to uproot things in the Torah. And hence, what I explained, I, Rav Chisda, on the Peites, explained that the Hafroshas, the Truma Temea, to exempt the Torah, Lo Asa V'lo Klum, that even that which was separated is nothing, is quite within the bounds of accepted halachic rulings. And we see that here. Toshma, dam shenitma, v'zorka b'shogeg hurtza, b'mezid lo hurtza. Sacrificial blood that became tome. And it was sprinkled on the altar, if it was unintentional, so hurtza. Hurtza means the sacrifice is accepted. If it was done intentionally, it's not acceptable. V'ahacha, dimidoraisa artzui meratzeh. on a, here we have a case where on a Torah level, even if the blood was tummy and it was intentionally sprinkled, it's acceptable. Artsum Ratsa means the carbon is acceptable. The Sanya, in this Tanaic source, we give you the background to that acceptability. Just skip the source for a moment and go to the end after the frame. The Amri Rabbanan Lo Hurtza. And the Rabbanan say, no, it's not acceptable. And then the owner, being told that his sacrifice was unacceptable, is going to bring another carbon, another sacrifice that from the Torah's standpoint he's not expected to bring. From the Torah's perspective, it's chulin. It's mundane. And he's bringing it into the temple courtyard as an offering. That's not allowed. And yet, we're saying to do that. So you see from here that the Torah, that the Rabbonin, that the Basin can be masna, can make conditions to their rulings and in effect undo something in the Torah. So now, we had said, we're just going back over the source that we did not read, we had said that from a Torah perspective, dam that became tomei, no matter what the circumstances are, when it's used as the sprinkling for the offering of a sacrifice, that's fine. It's an acceptable sacrifice. And how do you know that? Where do we know that from? Desanya. The source says as follows. Almahat tzitz meratzeh. The tzitz is the golden headplate worn by the Kohen Gadol. It has atonement powers. And what does it atone for? Al hadam, v'al habosar, v'al hachelev, shenitma. Dam is blood, basar is meat, chelev are the fats of sacrifices that are to be offered in every sacrifice that's offered. When these elements became defiled, shenitma, and we dashed underline, it's the focus of our discussion right now, is on the fact that it was defiled. Bein b'shogeg, bein b'mezid, bein b'ainiz, bein b'rotzen, bein b'yochid, bein b'tzibor. Whether it's unwitting, whether it's intentional, whether it's beyond their control, whether it's willing, whether it's private sacrifice or a public sacrifice. In all cases, these elements, including the blood that became tomei, it is an acceptable offering. The Amri Rabbonin, the Rabbonin come along and say, Lo Hurtza. It's not acceptable. That means the essential part of the sacrifice to make it effective, namely the blood offering, the blood sprinkling, is not acceptable. And what's the owner going to have to do? He's going to have to bring another sacrifice. On a Torah level, does he have to bring that? No. The Kohadar Mayel Chulin Lazor. And then he's going to be, Mayel means to bring in Chulin, that which is really not sanctified, into the Azorah and being offered as a sacrifice. That is forbidden. So Rav Chisto makes his point that Yesh Koyach Lachachomim Laakor Dovor Min HaTorah. They are, how is that manifest here? By bringing into the temple courtyard and offered as a sacrifice something that the Torah does not want you to do. Omar Rav Yosi Bar Chanina. So, Rabbo, in defense of Rabbo's position, so you see, Rav Yosi Bar Chanina says, "My lo hurtza de kamar," the original source that said "bemezid lo hurtza." What does that mean? Lahatir basar b'achila. It prevents the meat from being allowed to be eaten. Sacrificial meat is eaten sometimes by the owners, sometimes only by Kohanim, but in order for it to be eaten, the blood has to be sprinkled. But since you're dealing with an intentional sprinkling of tomei blood, so we say you cannot eat from the meat. But as far as the original fear, avol, the Gemara goes on, avol, bailim niskapru bo. But the owner does achieve his atonement that was effectuated through the offering of that particular sacrifice. Hence, he's not going to bring an additional sacrifice. There's no problem of Chulin Lazora arising here. Ah, sof, sof. But here the position taken by Rav Chisto comes back into play. There still is an example of an uprooting taking place. Sof komis akro achilas basar. Here we've dashed underline komis akro, the uprooting. That's the key word here. You do see an uprooting, namely the eating of the sacrificial meat. Uksiv achlu oisom asher kupar bohem. The pasuk expects the eating of the sacrificial meat, malame. This pasuk teaches us shakainim oichlu mubaylim miskaprim, through the eating of the meat on the part of the kohanim, the owner achieves his full atonement. So what do we see here? The rabbis are coming in and saying, don't do that which the Torah says you are to do. The Torah says, eat the meat. The rabbis are moving and saying, don't eat the meat. Is that not an uprooting of the Torah? Amale Rabbo comes, the Rabbo position is now defended. Shev yaltas shaini. The case of an uprooting, but through passive behavior, that is different. So Rabbo at this point is saying, my objection is where the rabbis move in a proactive fashion, uprooting something in the Torah. Taking something, for example, like truma, and saying, this is not truma anymore, it's chulin, that's proactive. That's an akira, mamish. The Torah telling you to eat meat and the rabbi saying don't eat it, that's not proactive, that's passive. They're simply telling you to desist from a certain action. That is not something that I was bothered by in the first place. What I was bothered by, says Rabba to Rav Chisda, is the initiative taken by the Rabbanan in a proactive manner to uproot something from the Torah. We continue at the top of Amud Beis. Rav Chisda comments. Now, we don't have this marked with a triangle, because it's not in effect a question and an answer per se. It's Rav Chisda observing. Omar Le, Rav Chisda says, Boi l'oisoivach, I had in mind, he said, Rav Chisda says to Rabbo, I had in mind to challenge you from several different topics. And the Gemara lists off the topics and Rashi elaborates on the topics. The case of Orel, Hazor, Izemel, Sodin Betzitzis, the Kivsei Aseres, V'Shoifer V'Lulav. Rashi, as I say, goes through all of the examples. We're not going to go through all of them. We're going to cite one or two of these examples. The case of Shofar, for example, and Lulav. These are mitzvos that when Shabbos coincides with the first day of Rosh Hashanah or the first day of Sukkot, one is expected to blow the shofar and to pick up a lulav. The Rabbanan came in and said, don't do it. Why not? Because if you're going to perform the mitzvah of shofar, blowing the shofar on Shabbos, or you're going to pick up a lulav on Shabbos in order to be yotzei the mitzvah, you might come, this is a rabbinic gzera, you might come to carry them in a public domain for Amos, and that is also to do from the Torah. So we, the rabbis, are telling you to desist from the mitzvah of shofar and lulav, even though the Torah expects you to do it, but we're telling you to sit and be passive. Don't do it. So Rav Chisda said initially, I was going to cite these and the other things mentioned as examples of where the rabbis move in and uproot something from the Torah. But hashta deshonis lon shevi al tase lo me'akerhu. Now that you're telling me that what the rabbis intervention in a passive fashion, where they tell you to desist from doing something, is not called uprooting. Kulunami, all of these cases that, as we said, are elaborated upon in Rashi, if you want to see all of the different cases, so by all means, look into Rashi. All of those represent cases of shev v'al tase ninhu. They are, albeit uprooting of the Torah, but in a desist fashion, in a passive fashion, where the rabbis are saying simply remain passive and with that attitude, so I'm not even going, I'm not going to raise these as proofs to the idea of the Chachamim having power to uproot. Because obviously what you, Rabbah, are concerned with is where the rabbis move in a proactive fashion, telling you to do something against the Torah, or declaring, in our case, declaring something that is truma, and in a positive fashion declaring it non-truma, declaring it chulin. Nevertheless, we continue. Toshma. Here we have a posuk that is quoted quite briefly, a lov tishmun. This deals with a prophet who is a known honorable true prophet. That's P-R-O-P-H-E-T. Afilu omer loch avor al achas mikol mitzvus shebetura. Even if he tells you to violate one of the Torah laws, kigon Elioba Har Carmel, hakol ufisha shmalo. If he tells you to violate a Torah mitzvah on a momentary basis, that means lufisha, not declaring permanently something not applicable, but momentarily. And the example cited is the story involving the prophet Elijah, the prophet, on Mount Carmel, where he confronted the false prophets of the idol Baal. And in that confrontation, a sacrifice was offered to the Almighty outside the Beis HaMikdash. That's called Shlutei Chutz. That's something that is, generally speaking, strictly forbidden. But Elio came along and offered, that's proactive, a proactive uprooting of something from the Torah. So here you see that the sages do have such a power to, in a proactive fashion, uproot something from the Torah. Rabbo responds, Shaini Hosam, that is different. Dichtiv a lov tishmon. There you have a scriptural license for that taking place. So it's not, you're not uprooting from the Torah. The Torah itself is saying, listen to him, listen to the prophet. Well, if the Torah is saying, then listen to him. So now, the Rav Chisda position argues, for ligmar mine, why not learn from it? Let that be the precedent, that there is a koyach of the Chachomim to oikir bekum v'yaseh, in a positive fashion, to uproot something from the Torah. Why can't that be a precedent setter then? So Rabbah will respond, migdar milsa shiny. Where the case of Elio Anovi cannot serve as a precedent. It was a result of extenuating circumstances that demanded an action, though against the Torah, in order to defend the Almighty and the Torah. That's Migdar from the word Goder. Migdar is to build a fence. When it's an extenuating circumstances in order to defend an otherwise emergency situation, then and only then are we allowing for that to happen. But to be a precedent setter across the boards, granting power to the sages of uprooting in a proactive fashion all kinds of things in the Torah, that no one ever said. Toshma. So again, Rav Chisda comes back with an attempt to show that we do uproot things from the Torah. This source deals with the realm of divorce. A husband sends a divorce document through an agent to his wife, and in this source we then see the husband annulling the get, declaring it void. So the source says, Bitlo mevutal. If the husband who sent the divorce document subsequently declares it void, it is void. And the woman who receives it, his wife that receives it, really is not entitled to marry another man. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Eino yochol lo levatlo v'lo lahosif al tano. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says a husband cannot annul, he cannot void a get, he cannot add to conditions that were stipulated in the divorce document. Im kein ma koyach besin yofe. Because if he were to be able to do that, where would where would we be able to appreciate the strength of the law of the courts? In other words, the rabbis said that a husband is not to annul a get. Once he sends a get, he is not to annul it. Now, that's very nice as far as the rabbis are concerned. They said not to do so. From a Torah perspective, is the get annulled? Yes. From a Torah perspective, a husband has the power to annul a get. Certainly before it receives her hands, if a husband annuls it, it is annulled. V'ha'acha, the Gemara says, D'midoraisa botel get. From the Torah perspective, the divorce document is in fact voided. U'mishum ma koyach bezdin, and because of our concern to preserve the authority of the rabbis, we are declaring the annulment to be non-binding. By saying the annulment is non-binding, the woman receives this get, and she is viewed as divorced. Now, on a Torah level, is she divorced? No, because the husband annulled it. But in order to preserve rabbinic authority that said, don't do such things, so we say that the woman is divorced. And what? Kosharino neshes ish la'alma. Here's a woman that, from the Torah perspective, is still married. The husband annulled the get. And we're saying, no, she's considered divorced, and we're allowing an Eishas Ish, a married woman, to marry someone else. A major Torah violation. So, what are we then demonstrating here? We're demonstrating that the rabbis have the power to, in effect, uproot something from the Torah. To present it in simplistic terms, the rabbis are taking a woman that is married and declaring her unmarried and sending her off, so to speak, to marry some other man while she's still married from the Torah. That's a tremendous example of uprooting something in a proactive fashion. So Rav Chisso is making his point here. He's telling us, you see this happening. So why do you, Rabbah, challenge my explanation that I offered in the case of the truma, the tithing of the from the tome on the Torah? Rabbah answers, Man de Mekadesh. When a person enters matrimony, Adaito de Rabbonin Mekadesh, the Afkin Rabbonin Lekidushin. One who marries a woman, he does so conditionally. Conditionally upon what? Upon accepting all the laws involving matrimony, and matrimony includes the laws of divorce. He does so, when a person enters marriage, he does so accepting upon himself that everything he does is in accordance with the laws of the rabbis. Now, if a person steps out of bounds, so then we say you were never really married, because your initial marriage was through accepting the rules of the rabbis. So, v'afkinu rabbonan l'kiddushin means the rabbis uproot, type of, let's say, retroactive declaration that you were never married, so that the woman that we're allowing now to marry someone else is in effect the woman that was never married to you in the first place. Omerle Ravina l'Ravashi, Hotenach de Kodesh Bekaspa. This analysis of the rabbis coming to uproot something, that's an analysis where the original marriage, the original kiddushin, was done through money. Practically speaking, what are we saying? That you married a woman by giving her money. Okay, so in actuality, money was transferred from the man to the woman. However, we discover later that this husband stepped out of bounds. He voided the get after it was sent through the agent. We said that's a violation of the rabbi's teachings, and therefore you were never married. And what about the money? Ah, the money that you gave her, That was not marriage money. It was a gift of money that you gave her. That's Hafkas Kiddushin. We're uprooting, because of his stepping out of bounds, we're uprooting the initial marriage, and the money that was given, we declare as all that money initially was a gift. It wasn't marriage money. So she was never married. It's like giving your neighbor a gift of money on your neighbor's birthday. That's no legal significance. So that's fine if the initial marriage was done through kesef, one of the three different means of establishing a marriage. The first Mishnah in Maseches Kiddushin says, "Oisha nikneis bekesef bishtar v'biya." Kesef is one of them. One of the other methods of initiating a marriage is through intimacy. Kodesh bebi'o mai iko lemeimar. How are you going to explain that case where the initial marriage was done through intimacy? What are you going to say? It didn't take place, but it did take place. How do you redefine intimacy? And yet you see that we are declaring something that objectively is a marriage as a non-marriage. And that would be in effect not because you stepped out of bounds and were therefore redefining things. How do you redefine intimacy? Ella, what? So this is a position taken by Rav Chisda in against Rabba. Rabba's explanation of the Afkin Rabbanan Likidushin, how are you going to apply that to the case of Bia? So Rabba answers, yes, I can do that here. Shavuha Rabbanan Labilasa Bilaznus. The Rabbanan, in fact, redefine his initial act that he thought he was doing as an act of intimacy for marriage purposes as an act of harlotry. So at this point, we don't see an example of the rabbis uprooting something. As far as the case with the Bittul HaGet, nothing was uprooted. It's simply that the original marriage never took place. And as such, you don't have an example of a married woman being declared free to marry someone else. She was never married. Toshma. And here, again, we have another attempt on the part of Rav Chisda to show that we do uproot things. We have a Tanaic source. This is our seventh attempt on the part of Rav Chisda to bring a source to bolster his position. Omer Rabbi Lozer ben Yankov, Shomati shebeis din makin voinshin shalom min haTorah. Rabbi Lozer ben Yankov says, I heard that the courts have the power to makin, is to hit, apply lashings and punishments, even if it's not in accordance with strict Torah guidelines. V'loi lavor al divrei Torah, elolasos siog l'Torah. Not with the intention of violating the Torah, but rather with an intention of strengthening, creating a fence in protection of the Torah. U'maisa b'adam echad, sherochav al sus b'shabbos b'mei avonim. So we have a double underline to highlight two cases where we see this kind of intervention on the part of the courts. There was an incident with an Odom Echad Sherochav al Sus b'Shabbos b'Yemei Yevonim. He was riding a horse on Shabbos. Now, the riding of a horse on Shabbos from a strictly Torah perspective is okay. It's not a malacha. It's not considered a constructive activity, one of the 39 different malachas that the Torah prohibits. Riding a horse is usur on a purely rabbinic level. The fear that if you ride a horse, you might come to break off a branch to serve as a whip for the horse. Now, breaking off the branch with that intention would be a Torah violation, but here he hasn't done it. He's just alighting a horse. He's riding upon a horse. What's wrong with that? Nothing from the Torah perspective. And yet, we find a person that was riding horse on Shabbos during the Greek period. The Greek period was characteristic of the Greek period were many Jews that became Hellenists. They basically abandoned the Torah and its teachings in favor of a Greek culture, society, and practice. So you have a person behaving like this in those days. They brought him to the court, v'sakluhu, and they stoned him to death. Lo mitnei sheroi lekach, not because he was deserving of that. Ela shehashot zricha lekach. It was those times that demanded this exceptional behavior on the part of the court. You can see the Rashi toward the end of the column, the Rashi commentary, Tzricha Lekach, the last line, he says, Hoysa es tzora, v'hoyu prutzim bavera. It was a time of trouble, and the Jewish society was characterized by massive sinning. So because of mass sinning and mass degradation of the Torah, the court is provided, the court is provided with the power to take such extensive action in order to make the point that there is a Torah and there is Shulchan Aruch and there is Halacha that Jews are bound by. V'shuv Maisa, another incident. Ba'adam Echot Shitiach B'ishto Tachas Ateina. It was a man that behaved promiscuously, although with his wife. What did he do? He had intimacy. He conducted his intimacy with his wife under a fig tree, which for our purposes would mean an act of intimacy which demands true modesty, and he did it in public. They view the based into Hilkuhu, and they brought him to court and lashed him. Lo mitnei sheroi lekach. There's no punishment of lashings for having intimacy with your wife, even if it happens to be in public. The act itself is allowed. It's a man with his wife, with his legally acceptable spouse. So the act of intimacy per se is not problematic. It's just where it was done, under what kind of surrounding circumstances. So that doesn't, it's true there's a violation of modesty, but that doesn't introduce a penalty of lashing. So why was he lashed? Elo shahashah tzricha lekach. Again, as we said before, it was a societal problem. It was a society characteristic of mass immodesty. And in order to counterbalance that mass immodesty, this was necessary. So what do you see from here? You see now you're not allowed to kill someone, not supposed to be killed in a certain, and not even allowed to hit someone that's not allowed to be lashed, and yet we are killing and we are lashing. It's a proactive uprooting of the Torah on the part of the courts. So Rav Chisto is making his point, and Rabbo responds, Migdar Milsa Shiny. We saw this answer before when we saw the case of Eliyahu Bahar Carmel introduced. There were extenuating momentary circumstances that demanded the intervention in order to preserve the Torah. So we have a concept of a momentary uprooting of the Torah in order to preserve the larger picture, Torah observance in general. And as we said before, as far as Rabbah is concerned, that is not an example of something that bothers me. But now, in the superstructure of the Gemara, we have to relate back to our previous shiur as well, the Gemara from Daf Pei Tes, where we saw Rav Chisda, who was represented in this particular sukkah by the inverted triangle. Rav Chisda had declared the tithing from the defiled on the pure as being ineffective altogether, where even the tithe is a non-tithe, and the rabbis thereby declare something that the Torah would recognize as truma as being non-truma. That's a proactive uprooting of something from the Torah, and this was something that upset, in other words, Rav Chisto's interpretation of that Tanaic source upset Rabbo. And you notice the last triangle in this whole give and take is a triangle with its point facing up, leaving us with Rabbah's position presented as, we'll say, the last word. And in effect, then, he remains, we'll say, with his discomfort with Rav Chisdo's interpretation that you saw back on Pei Tes Amud Aleph. The alternative interpretation, that of Rav Nosson Ber Boshia, would probably be the route that Rabbo would take in explaining the Tanaic source back there on in the middle of Pei Tes Amud Aleph. We continue with the Gemara. V'lo ze v'ze mitamin lo. We spoke about the woman who remarried based on the testimony of one witness, and the husband then came back. She has to leave both husbands, and neither one, if they happen to be Kohanim, neither one are allowed to defile themselves in her burial. Minola, from where do we know this? So the Gemara answers. The answer takes a few lines to develop, a long answer. Dichtiv, you have a pasuk in the context of Kohanim. It says, "Ki'im l'she'eroi hakorov elov." A kohen is entitled or is expected to defile himself l'she'ero. The Omar Mor, and the Gemara continues by saying, "She'ero zu ishto." The word she'ero means one's wife. Very simply stated, a kohen is metame to his wife. Uksiv lo yatame baal bamov lehechalo. There's another pasuk that says a person, a kohen, is not entitled to defile himself to his dead wife. So we have what would seem to be a contradiction in psukim. The resolution is as follows: yesh baal shemitame v'yesh baal shein mitame. There are cases of a husband defiling himself, and there are cases where he is not to defile himself. How is that to be understood? Metamehu liishtok sheira. He is entitled to defile himself to a woman that is acceptable to him. V'eino metame liishtok psula. But he cannot metame himself. He is a kohen. He can't be metame to defile himself to a woman that he is not allowed to be with. And in our situation, you have a woman that is not allowed to be with husband number two. She was an ashes ish with him, and it's quite and technically speaking, legally speaking, she's not allowed to be with husband number one either, because you have a case of a woman, a married woman, who willingly had intimacy with a second man. Neither husband is entitled to benefit from articles that she finds. In general, a woman, a married woman that finds articles, it belongs to her husband. Taimo mai omer rabbonon metzias isha labayla. In general, why was it ruled that the found articles of married women go to their husbands? Ki hechi velo teheve le eva. So that there shouldn't be a sense of enmity between husband and wife. After all, a husband is obligated to support his wife. So he's on the giving end. And we made a point extensively in our previous year. So those of you who are familiar with our discourse at the end of our previous year concerning the centrality of money in the eyes of the Talmud regarding the human psyche can all the more appreciate this. A man is always giving. He's giving mizonos. He's supporting his wife. Giving, giving, giving. If a person is left in that position, always giving and never receiving, that is that creates fertile ground for evil, for enmity. So in order to avoid that, and rather to create an environment of conviviality, of harmony, we say, look, lady, you are getting from your husband support. Give to your husband in return articles that you find. So that's in order to create harmony, to preserve the marriage. However, over here, where you have an illegal marriage, let there be enmity and more enmity. And we'll certainly accomplish that by having these husbands seeing the woman, the wife, keeping the found articles. Neither husband are entitled to benefit from income that she produces. Why is it that women, married women in general, married women are to give their income to their husbands? Because she is benefiting from his support. In this case, since he is not supporting her, remember, we're talking about a marriage that's unacceptable. Maise yodeho lav didei. So her profit is not to be given to him. If after all, the woman's profits were given to the husband in exchange for her being supported by the husband, well, he's not supporting her, so her profits don't go to him. Velo mefer nidoreha. One of the characteristics of a husband-wife relationship is that a husband has the rights to void her vows. That's a Torah provided for right that a husband has. If a husband hears wife making a vow and on the same day he decides to void it, to annul it, he can do that. Taimol mai omer rachmona bal mefer. Why is it that the Torah provides for that a husband annuls his wife's vows? And by the way, when we speak about a husband annulling his wife's vows, it applies to certain kinds of vows. Amongst those vows would be, imagine a woman takes a vow that she is not going to bathe anymore, or she is not going to use cosmetics anymore. Well, a husband who hears that, he's going to end up with an ugly wife. So we say that the Torah allows him to annul, to be mefer, her nidorim. So why is that? Kidei shelo tizgane, so that she should not become abhorrent in his eyes. We want to preserve the married couple. Aha, but in our case, where the marriage is illicit, tiskana b'tiskana, let her become abhorrent and all the more so. So that if she vows not to bathe, we'll be very happy with that vow remaining, and of course preventing the husband from annulling that, so that he'll want to get rid of her. He'll want to separate from her. Hoiso bas Yisrael nifsala minakuna. The woman that had been married in our story heard that her husband died because of the testimony of one witness. She then went ahead and married another man, and the husband came back. You have a woman that was basically a married woman living with another man. So that disqualifies her from ever marrying a Kohen in the future. The Gemara at the top of Tzadi Aleph Omer Aleph says, Pshita. Well, of course she's disqualified. Rashi points out, Zona. She is a Zona. She is what the Torah classifies as a Zona, one of the types of women that are prohibited to the Kuna. A divorcee is prohibited, and a Zona is prohibited. A woman who experienced forbidden intimacy at the Kores level, she is prohibited to a Kohen. And we said to the Kores level, that makes her into a Zona. The Gemara says, you know, you're right, that to this point of her being disqualified from the Huna is really obvious. So why is it in the Mishnah? Baslevi min ha-maiser it's the Richale. The Mishnah really had an agenda of getting to the next level, to describe a daughter of a Levi. Levium are people that are entitled to the Miser Rishon tithe, one of the several tithes that are separated from produce, and the Miser Rishon is given to Levium. The Levi family, including the women in the family, eat from that, the Miser Rishon. So if you have a Bas Levi that is the subject of our story of the woman who married a second husband, well, she, our mission says, becomes disqualified from the Miser, and that is a novel point. The Gemara asks, not only is it novel, is it even correct? Ubas Levi min ha-Miser mi mifsala biznus? Does a Bas Levi become prohibited from Meiser because of illicit relations. V'hotanya levi shed levi oshenish base oshenivalobi laznus. A woman from a Levi family that was captured. And when a woman is captured, we suspect that she had intimacy with non-Jews, with the captors, or she was involved in intimacy, other forbidden forms of intimacy, like with Gentiles, with slaves. And it says in the source, "Noisla Meiser v'achas." We give her, nevertheless, we give her Meiser, and she eats from that. So what is the Mishnah telling me that this married woman who entered marriage with a second man becomes disqualified from the Meiser? By letter of the law, she's entitled to it. So Amar Rav Sheshes, Knosa, Rav Sheshes says it's a fine that we impose upon her. The Mishnah also taught Bas Kohen Mina Truma. If she was the daughter of a Kohen, she becomes disqualified from eating Truma. And what the Gemara points out is the chiddush of the Mishnah is afilu betruma derabbanan, even from rabbinic type truma. Rashi explains, as far as Torah level truma, that I don't need to teach you. We saw that she loses out in Meiser. Certainly she'll lose out in truma, which is a more severe area of tithing. But even rabbinic required truma, this woman who is a Bas Kohen, it will lose out on, will be deprived from that. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.